Welcome to Witness to Yesterday, the podcast of the Champlain Society. My name is Larry Ostola. The Avro Arrow is a fascinating part of Canada's aviation history, but for decades, questions about the plane and the program that developed it have lingered. Was the Arrow really as technologically sophisticated as some at the time claimed? Was it too expensive for Canada at the time? Why was the program suddenly cancelled, and who was responsible for the decision that was made? I'm going to delve into these questions and others with my guest today, Palmiro Campagna, who's the author of a new book entitled The Avro Arrow, For the Record, published by Dundurn Press in 2023. Palmiro Campagna is a retired electrical engineer who spent 34 years with the Department of National Defense. He's the author of four books related to the Avro Arrow, including Storms of Controversy, The Secret Avro Arrow Files Revealed, and Requiem for a Giant, AV Row Canada and the Avro Arrow. All of his books are based on detailed archival records, including a number of documents which had to be declassified in order to be accessed. Palmiro, thanks for joining me today. It's great to have a chance to speak to you.
Oh, good afternoon. It's my pleasure.
Why don't we start with some context? What were the factors that led to Canada's decision to develop a supersonic jet interceptor in the 1950s?
Well, we're talking early 1950s, and there was a concern among the West and allies that the Soviets were building supersonic attack bombers. And in order to counter that, we would need supersonic aircraft. Now, to do that, in order to develop, design, test, produce, etc., it takes a long time, a long lead time. So the decision was made early on to commence the Aero project. Now, that was done, however, after consulting, that is the Royal Canadian Air Force, consulting with the United States and their British counterparts to determine whether or not they had any aircraft that might be suitable to protect the expanse of Canada. And they did not, and they gave their support to Canada to go ahead with the Aero project. And so it started in 1952-53.
So, and that's a really interesting point, because in these days of debates over, you know, the question of military procurement and the state of the Canadian Armed Forces, the development of the Arrow was nothing short of remarkable, and this was a real surprise for me reading the book. You point out that the plane went from initial design to first flight in a five-year span from 1953 to 1958, at a time when jet plane development was in its infancy. And I'm going to repeat that because people may not believe me. From initial design to first flight, over 5 years. How did this extraordinary achievement come about?
Well, there are a number of factors. There's differences between what we do today and back then, in that there was not a long, lengthy, competitive process. AV Row had been established to build military aircraft, and so the government, when they made their decision, they went straight to AV Row and said, you know, let's get on with this. The second thing, which is important, is that a decision was made early on by all the parties concerned that they would not build an initial prototype by hand, or if you will, which is what they used to do, but in fact, they would build the assembly line and used the initial pre-production models, you know, as their so-called prototypes. But doing that, they would eliminate that entire hand-built prototype stage. So that cut out a lot of time. The problem with that, of course, is it's a risky proposition, because if your aircraft doesn't, you know, perform the way it's supposed to, at least the first few models, you've got an assembly line there that, you know, is going to have to be retooled, and, you know, who knows what. So in order to mitigate that risk, Avro undertook an extensive testing program. They tested the designs in wind tunnels. They built 1/8 scale models that they launched off of Nike rockets. These models were instrumented so that they could get information on the flight characteristics. In the plant, they built test rigs to test out the various systems in the airplane. They even had a wooden mock-up that they used to define how they would run the wiring and such in the final products. So it was really a rigorous testing regime. The other thing, of course, is that they had some brilliant people that were working on the whole aircraft. The brilliant engineers, technicians, managers, all the way through. It was a really professional team that put this together in short order.
Well, it really was, a remarkable achievement. But let me just get to the question of the sources that you used for a second. So because of the interest of the Champlain Society in documentary history, I have to ask you about the documents that you accessed. How challenging was it to get access to what would have been, in many cases, classified documents related to the Aero program? And I mean, you also, I understand from the book, had the opportunity to personally interview a number of those, including, you know, test pilots like Jan Zurakowski, who were directly involved in the program, which must have been absolutely remarkable. So tell me about your sources and how you access them.
Right. So basically, my sources mostly came from the National Archives here in Ottawa, which is referred to as Library and Archives Canada. Now, back in the day, and I'm talking the mid-80s, even our historian Desmond Morton, the late Desmond Morton, unfortunately, he had complained that it was very difficult to get access to records, on the Avro Aero from these sources. So I took a little different tact. The first time I went there, yes, I asked for what they had on the Avro Aero, and I got a little document, that little file folder of about 10 pages or so, which was useless. So the way the archives works is they have subject headings that you can access. And so I asked for anything related to national defense policy, continental defense policy, aircraft procurements. In other words, keywords that really didn't relate directly to the Aero, but might have something there. And as a result, I would wait on the order of a month or some weeks or what have you, and I would go through thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pages of information, much of which had nothing to do with the Aero, but then I would, in fact, hit the jackpot and find all kinds of records dealing with the Avro Aero. And once I would get, say, a memo, the way memos are written, kind of like today's emails, they'll have a CC on the bottom, carbon copy 2, and that would point me to a particular department that might also have received information about the Aero. So then I would go back and ask for, again, generic files related to aircraft and development and such, from various departments, be it National Defense, be it procurement, the Department of Defense production back then. And so I ended up amassing a massive amount of information that I guess others had not had the opportunity to get hold of. Luckily, as I said, it took on the order of a few months, most of the time, because the records would have to go back to the originators to determine, what could be accessed, what could be released and whatnot. And I got lucky in that just about everything was declassified for me, and this includes secret, top secret documents. I did get one that had some portions excised, and I was able to inquire, why that was the case. And as it turns out, it really had nothing to do with the Aero per se, but rather defense tactics in the North that could possibly still be relevant today. And, as far as I was concerned, I could care less about that. I said, that's fine. I don't need that. My interest was solely on the Aero. Now, having said all this, there was at least one document that did take on the order of 2 years to get. And what happened there was it was a document that was actually at the National Research Council's Aviation Library, the J.H. Parkin Library. And it was written by British scientists and engineers who had come to Canada to review the entire Aero project from a technical perspective. So when I requested access there, they said, oh, this is D&D. So they sent it to National Defense. National Defense looked at it and said, oh, no, this is Great Britain. They sent it to Great Britain. And they looked at it, said, no, this is D&D Canadian. anyways, the thing made a circuit for 2 years before somebody in Britain finally said, this is ridiculous, declassified the whole thing, and sent me a complimentary copy, which was great because there was a significant number of pages I would have had to have photocopied and paid for. And it had a technical analysis by the British engineers that basically confirmed how good the aircraft was. So that's really the story. The other part of it is I presumed at the time that since Eisenhower was the president at the time, that there might be something in the Eisenhower Library. So I ended up writing to those folks, and they had no problem sending me documents very quickly, just the time it took to send a letter. So I did get some good information from them. I also received information from the United States Air Force, Maxwell Air Force Base historical people. I tried Great Britain, but they really didn't have much. But basically, I attacked all these different sources and got lucky by using those generic terms. Today, because of all of that, you can go to the Library and Archives Canada web pages, and they have now what are called thematic guides. So if you do put in Avro Arrow, you will see the list of documents, file folders and such, pertaining directly to the Arrow.
Congratulations, because it sounds like you really had to do a lot of legwork and a lot of detective work, but it seems to have produced some pretty good results in the end. While you were speaking, you mentioned a technological assessment of the Arrow that was carried out by the British. And that's what I'd like to get onto now, is the question of technology. Just how groundbreaking was the technology that was involved in the Arrow, in your view?
The one thing that you normally hear about is that the Arrow was a fly-by-wire aircraft, without going into the details of what that means. Basically, it was the first supersonic production fly-by-wire aircraft. There was another one in the United States that was a test aircraft. So by way of example, after the Arrow, the next fly-by-wire production that I could find was the F-16 in 1974. And we're talking 1958-59. After that was the F-18 later on in the early 80s. The other significant feature of the Arrow was in the hydraulic system, where they were using what's called 4,000 pound per square inch hydraulics. The next aircraft that I was able to find that had that same 4,000 PSI, because its contemporaries were all at 3,000 PSI, was the B-2 stealth bomber from 1987. And the reason I was able to find that was because when the stealth bomber was revealed, one of the points made in an article that was written in Aviation Week and Space Magazine pointed out that it had this great, 4,000 PSI. And that's important for a number of different reasons that we don't need to get into. But it gives you an idea of how far in advance the Arrow was. They also, in the Arrow, were using transistorized components for a lot of the electronics and such. And then, of course, there was the advanced use of titanium and other metal alloys and whatnot. So the whole point here is that, yes, there may be, somebody that'll say, oh, but there was another airplane that had the 4,000 PSI that I missed, or, oh, there was another plane that had this and that. The key point is that all of these advances were in the same platform on the same airplane, and that's what differentiated it from all the others at the time. And the day of the rollout, Aviation Week magazine had headlines that said Canadian Avro Arrow displays advanced features on rollout. And I think that article is still available online for folks. I believe I quoted the reference in the book. So it was that combination of things. And the engineering report from Britain basically confirms everything I just said. So yes, it was significantly advanced, not to mention it was a beautiful looking airplane even today.
Well, and I think, Palmiro, that if I remember correctly in the book, I'm correct in saying that the Iroquois engine that was Canadian built, that was intended for the Arrow, was also very advanced as well, was it not?
Yes, absolutely. So again, with the Iroquois, the decision had been made to work with titanium, which was a very durable, lightweight material. From scratch and build it with that, compared to other engines of the time that were basically steel, perhaps with titanium blades or something. And anyway, there were significant differences there where Avro had to undertake some rather interesting manufacturing techniques. They did some groundbreaking work in that area. So yes, the Iroquois engine was quite an advance in and of itself. I believe at the time it was dubbed one of the most powerful engines in the world.
One of the criticisms that was leveled at the Arrow was its cost, but you argue that that was not really the issue. Walk us through the debate.
Right. The issue was really the changing threat. Now, what I mean by that is, and I've quoted from a report from the CIA from March of 1957, that the Soviets, it was projected that they would be launching a satellite within a few months, perhaps, and also that they were ahead in missile intercontinental ballistic missile developments. And they actually projected what they would have in the years 62, 63, 64, etc. So the whole issue was the changing threat. It was called the missile gap, that the Soviets were far ahead of us in that development. Now, of course, a few months after that, which was in October, the date that the Arrow was rolled out, they actually did launch Sputnik, the satellite. And so this gave credence, obviously, to that whole issue. So what the argument was that, well, if we're changing, if the threat is changing, do we need to continue spending money on the Arrow, given that the threat that it was to defend against, the bombers, was diminishing? And as proof of that, we have in January of 1958, in the House of Commons, our Minister of National Defense, George Perks, stood up and basically said that the future of the Arrow depended solely on the nature of the threat. And as long as the threat existed, the project would continue. We also had later on our ambassador, Norman Robertson, who mused about whether or not it was prudent to be spending so much money and effort in something that might be obsolete before it was put into service. And by obsolete, he didn't mean from a technology perspective, but rather, again, because the threat was changing, would it be worthwhile still pushing forward? Now, we also have the chiefs of staff later on in August of 58. They submitted their own report where they said that they had grave doubts as to whether a limited number of aircraft of the high cost of the Arrow, so nobody's arguing about the cost in that sense, but whether or not it would provide defense returns commensurate with the expenditure in view of the changing threat. So again, here they're linking the cost aspect with the threat. In other words, bang for the buck. You know, we're spending this much money. Are we going to get anything for that? Later on in September of 58, we have the Minister of Finance, Donald Fleming, the fellow who knows what the cost is going to be. And he says that he put the safety of the country ahead of finances, and that the problem now was that it was the military authorities that had decided that the aircraft, that the Arrow, was not necessary. So again, he doesn't say this thing is breaking the bank, we got to kill it. He says the military authorities just decided it was not necessary. He also adds in that he supported the program in 1957. And this was at a time when the costs, you know, had been increasing, and yet he supported. We move on into February the 6th, February the 10th of 1959, and we see additional memos from the chiefs of staff that the same wording is used, you know, that they don't see that they're going to get the defense return commensurate with the expense. And so they advise canceling the Arrow and bringing in the Bomark missile. Now, the Bomark missile, of course, was an anti-aircraft missile. It was not an intercontinental ballistic missile. So herein lies this debate in relation to cost. Later on, after the cancellation, in a meeting between our Minister of National Defense and his American counterparts, even Perks corrects somebody, one of his other ministers, who says that, you know, we were told 2 years ago that the Arrow was, that there was no longer a bomber threat. Perks interjects and says, no, we canceled the arrow, not because there was no threat, but because there was a reduced threat, and we bought the Bomark missile to take care of that reduced threat. And then even in his memoirs, John Diefenbaker himself also says that the matter was finally decided by the inability of the chiefs of staff to report any new developments, any new military developments that would justify the arrow's production. And if we look at the American records that I quote from, they basically say the same thing, although they add in one extra factor that we might get into a bit later on. So we have this consistency that the issue is not affordability per se. The issue is bang for the buck.
So it's really, if I understand correctly, this idea of a changing threat really becomes critical in terms of the future of the arrow.
Yes, absolutely. Again, if you don't have, you're building it to defend against the supersonic bomber threat, that threat is diminishing, then the thinking starts to become, well, why are we doing this? We should now be switching our attention to the intercontinental ballistic missile and what we're going to do about that. But they bring in the Bomark issue as a way of taking care of any additional, should there still be a reduced threat, so to speak. So the Bomark factors in very heavily into the debate of the cancellation.
The Arrow program proceeds. There's a number of aircraft that are produced. There are test flights that are carried out. There's various types of analyses that are done. But then it all comes to a crashing halt on what became known as Black Friday. What happened on that day?
Well, exactly. So on Black Friday, February 20th, 65 years ago plus, the government, again, John Diefenbaker, getting advice from the chiefs of staff, from the Minister of National Defense, that the arrow was no longer necessary, he finally had to take the decision to cancel the program. Of course, he's been vilified for it, and he has said that over the years. But again, he was acting on the advice, on the recommendations of George Perks, his Minister of National Defense, and Charles Foulkes, the Chairman Chiefs of Staff Committee. The interesting thing is that in those same documents, you will see that the Chief of the Air Staff was not on board with that. He wanted the arrow, or as he said, an aircraft comparable to the Arrow, which, of course, there weren't any at the time. So he was not on board, but the recommendation was presented as if everyone, in fact, was on board.
So you mentioned the fact, and this is often cited, that, Prime Minister John Diefenbaker and his government have borne the bulk of the criticism for the cancellation of the Arrow program. But based on the research that you've done and so on, at the end of the day, who do you think should bear the responsibility for the decision? Who was pushing the hardest, I guess I would say?
Well, I would have to go back to the Minister of National Defense, George Perks, and his cohort, the Chairman Chiefs of Staff Committee, Charles Foulkes, those two fellows, in particular Perks, as the minister.
One subject that we haven't really touched upon, but which has been raised over the years, I think, is the role of the United States, if any, in the cancellation. Do you think that there was an attempt on the part of the Americans to protect and promote their own defense industry? Or is it possible that they just thought that maybe Canada had bitten off more than it could chew with the development of a cutting-edge aircraft? Or do you think there were other factors at play? What do you make of potential American involvement in all of this?
Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question. As I said earlier, when the project started, both the U.S. and Britain, in this case, urged Canada to continue. By 1955, there were developments in American aircraft, and the Canadians actually asked the U.S. If we should, in fact, continue the Aero project. The U.S. looked at the question, they looked at their fighters, they looked at the Aero's capabilities, and they came back and they said, yes, proceed. Now, I've put those actual documents in the book. You can actually read them. So they were in support. But then as we start approaching the 1957-58 timeframe, and we have this missile gap issue that we talked about earlier, the situation changes. So in 1958, or early, we have the United States Air Force, General Putt, who basically tells our ambassador that he would like to see Avro Arrows in squadron service. So on the one hand, you know, people are asking me, well, how could you say the Americans, you know, were not in support of this when they actually wanted to have it? And here's where we have to make a distinction. So the USAF people, of course, they wanted the shiny new toy, and they were all prepared to bring in the Arrow. The Secretary of the Air Force, who's at that meeting, basically says no. So now you have a divide between the USAF and the bureaucrats and the politicians. So that no becomes more forceful with subsequent meetings. And George Perks himself, as the minister, is on record, actually. There was an interview with him that people can listen to, where he actually says that he was told by the Deputy Secretary of Defense that Canada didn't need the Arrow because the U.S. had lots of aircraft that we could take. And he expresses in that interview that his dilemma was if he were to cancel the Arrow, Canada would be without protection until the time such that the Bismarck missiles would be installed. So there would be a gap there. But he rectifies it when he says that all he had to do was allow the Americans, Air Force, to practice and train in our Canadian bases in the north, and that they would protect us in that intervening period. Those aren't my words. Those are there from George Perks. You can listen to those. Now, in addition to that, yeah, it's pretty startling. I think his words are, you know, I put my pride in my pocket and talked about this deal. In addition to that, in another interview, he actually says that the Americans were pressuring the Canadian military to sign the NORAD agreement, which we eventually did. And the NORAD agreement was followed up with the NORAD plan that had, you know, the requirement for the Bismarck, which is the other reason why Perks was saying, well, we needed to get the Bismarck in order to support the NORAD plan. So, you know, you're getting these little pressures. But the big one comes in the middle of August, August the 4th and 5th. Now, from the Canadian records, I knew that there had been a meeting in this time period, August of 1958, and it was supposed to be, according to the Canadian records, about the what are called the defense sharing arrangements. And this was a series of arrangements with reciprocal intentions that would allow, at least on the Canadian side, to Canadian industries to participate in the defense contracts of the United States, you know, of which they had thousands compared to Canada, at least hundreds anyways. So what I found and put in this new book, in the second edition here, were the minutes of that meeting, and I found those in the records of the United States. And that was August 4th and 5th. And over those 2 days, yes, the Americans said that the Arrow was a good aircraft, but they basically promoted their own and said that theirs was good enough for their purposes. But then over and above that, the Secretary of Defense, Neil McElroy, is quoted as saying that the U.S. government did not want Canada to build complex weapon systems. So, of course, the question becomes, is that code word for the Arrow, or is he talking about future, or what? The Canadian ambassador, Norman Robertson, is quoted as answering back that Canada, we cannot cancel the Avro Arrow. So he knows exactly what McElroy is talking about. And he goes on to explain why we can't cancel the Arrow. For his part, George Perks is there, and he says, well, maybe we could build, you know, a different aircraft, like an Arctic patrol aircraft, you know, as if to say that that's not a complex weapon system. McElroy digs in and says that he would like to see Canada build only components, and that if we did that, that the problems of taxes and tariffs related to those defense sharing arrangements could be made to disappear. So it's as if he's holding out a carrot. You cancel this, we'll give you that. And the question then becomes, did any of that impact the decision to cancel the Arrow? Now, further American documents that I quote from, and there's at least two or three of them there, they all seem to suggest that yes, they did, at least from the American perspective, that the Arrow was canceled not only because of the changing threat, they repeat that, but now they add in also to give Canada chances in participating in those defense sharing arrangements. How much more is there, I don't know, but those three documents all relate. And, you know, you start to wonder exactly what was happening. The tragedy of all of this is that we didn't have these documents available when these people were still alive and we could ask for clarifications. The other thing that we don't know is why did the United States government and Neil McElroy not want Canada to finish completing the Arrow and only focus on components? As you asked, was it because there was lobbying from their own industry? You know, they didn't want competition. Well, we know that that is a fact because that comes up in other documents. Was it because of national security that they didn't want the manufacturing secrets, what have you, from the Arrow program to make their way to the Soviet Union? And it has been proven that there was a mole in the Arrow plant at the time. Was it because, as you said, they just didn't, you know, felt we bit off more than we could chew? Unfortunately, those questions, you know, they're left to the realm of speculation because we just didn't have, you know, the documents at the time.
Well, Palmiro, I think that's all we have time for right now. But I would encourage people who are interested in the Arrow to take a look at your book because it really is fascinating reading. And I certainly learned a great deal about the history of the Arrow and its development. And on that note, I'd like to thank you very much for joining me today. My guest today was Palmiro Campagna. His book, The Avro Arrow, For the Record, was published by Dundurn Press in 2023. You've been listening to Witness to Yesterday. Please visit our website at www.champlainsociety.ca. The best way you can support this podcast is by becoming a subscribing member of the Champlain Society. If you like what you've heard, let your friends know by forwarding this podcast through the social media of your choice. You can also send us an email at info@champlainsociety.ca. This podcast is made possible by the members of the Champlain Society who work hard to bring to life original documents in Canadian history. We want to thank the L.R. Wilson Institute of History at McMaster University, as well as a consortium of Canadian scholarly book publishers that includes the University of Toronto Press, UBC Press, McGill Queen's University Press, the University of Regina Press, and the University of Ottawa Press. My name is Larry Ostola. This interview was recorded on March the 5th, 2024. It was produced by Jessica Schmidt and supported by the University of Toronto Press Journal team, who also support the Champlain Society.